At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. Organized crime and TikTok ads. The NAO has a report on franchising. We'll look at that. Market exit. Are the protections good enough? Plus, UCAS figures are out and who's paying a living wage? It's all coming up.
The example of the accounts you just gave, Jim, is an extreme version of profiteering. And what I would like to know is whether the universities that are franchising to that provider are aware of the high levels that the provider is taking on that.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and here to tighten up the sector's safeguards, as usual, three terrific guests. Nicola Dandridge is Professor of Practice in Higher Education Policy at the University of Bristol. Nicola, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I don't know if it's a highlight, but I'm a member of the board of the University of Glasgow, and yesterday I joined their Student Experience Committee. I'm a member of that too, and it's just always completely fascinating having that insight into Scotland, which in many respects it's the same, students suffering from, you know, cost of living and all the rest of it, but there is such a different feel in Scotland, and it's something that I think we just always need to take into account. Different country, different administration, different priorities. Fascinating
stuff. And Jonathan Grant is director at Different Angles. Jonathan, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, at a professional level, I think I said this last time as well, but data. I've been doing a bunch of multivariate analyses on our project looking at the cost drivers of peer review, which is fascinating. But at a personal level, my son Noah, 16-year-old son, signed off on the proofs of a collection of poems this week. So keep an eye out for that book later in the year.
Well, do. And Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, Jim, this week I've been spending some time with middle managers as part of a development programme run by former Vice-Chancellor of the University of Lincoln and friend of the show, Mary Stewart. And she brought me on to talk about the student condition. And it was just really fascinating to hear about how some of those individuals are kind of coping with change agendas and kind of and the kind of work that they're doing to try and kind of be good leaders in that context. And that's always really, I think they were sort of very underappreciated a group of people, so it was really nice to spend some time with them and hear their stories.
Great stuff. So yes, we start this week with organised crime. The NAO has been digging into franchising, Debbie.
Yeah, so the National Audit Office has produced a report on franchise provision in universities, and this is where a university validates courses that are delivered by a partner. And we have covered this on the site in the past, where we have raised concerns about a number of things that feature in the National Audit Office report. So basically, the conclusion is that there's still quite a lot of kind of ambiguity about who exactly is responsible for these students and how that works, and a number of sort of places where it's kind of quite possible that the system could be open to fraud. So we learn from the report that there have been several instances in the past couple of years where there has been significant evidence of fraud has been raised, and the Student Loans Company and OFS have been working to uncover what's going on behind that. And it's raised these questions about the recruitment practices of some of these providers, the extent to which we have evidence about the degree of engagement of the students, whether those students are kind of able to stay on course and complete, whether those students are even students in some cases. And the conclusion is not necessarily that there is a kind of smoking gun, but there is a recognition that the sort of oversight and safeguards in this area probably need to be tightened up if public money and potentially some really quite vulnerable people are going to be safeguarded. So the Public Accounts Committee has launched an inquiry, and that is now taking evidence. And so we will continue to sort of see, I think, regulation in this area to get tighter and tighter.
Nicola, one of my reflections reading the report is that the kind of respective responsibilities between TFE, OFS and the SLC all look like a bit of a mess.
I don't know if it's a mess, but I think the NAO are right to identify it in that there's overlapping responsibilities. But then, there's overlapping responsibilities in quite a few areas. I think what they do flag is that the SLC's powers are limited to fraud in relation to the individual student, not the providers. And the OFS hasn't got power to investigate fraud. And it's just, it just seems to be falling between the cracks. And one of the things that came over to me really strongly is just how the incentives work here. So you know, they talk about the fact there's no regulation of agents and the referral charges up to 500 quid a student, and franchisor providers retaining up to 30% of the tuition fee. You know, you put all this together with the sort of slight lack of clarity about oversight responsibilities, and you can see why they're concerned, why the PAC are going to do an inquiry into it.
Yeah, Jonathan, I mean, you know, in many ways, I guess even if you're relaxed about private providers, once all sorts of people are able to make all sorts of money at various levels, this kind of thing becomes almost inevitable, doesn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say inevitable. I think we discussed this last time Nicola and myself were on the podcast. And that was in December 2022. So I think that's quite an interesting gap it's taken for the NEO to get to this stage, although obviously they have to do their research. I think there are two sort of points here which I'd sort of make. One, I do think we need to differentiate between the nature of the provider and the funding. So the issue here is basically the government-backed student loan scheme. If you didn't have that and it was all private tuition, it wouldn't be an issue. And then, as Nicola says, the issue is this is falling between the cracks of the regulatory framework. And actually, some of the incentives seem extremely high and, you know, arguably immoral if providers or the franchises are retaining 30% of fees and such like. So that seems, in my mind, to be the issue. How do you tighten up the regulatory framework that fills in their gaps? The other thing, Jim, just a shout out to Wonky, because I think you guys, you picked up in a piece in the New York Times, didn't you? And then you followed through on it. And this is a good example, I think, of the impact an organization like Wonky can have. The fact that it has now been picked up by the National Audit Office and PAC is important, because it potentially undermines the credibility in the sector. And the final thing I would say, which the NAO report says as well, such arrangements are not wrong. The fact that we have franchise provision very much meets certain requirements in the sort of marketplace. So we need to be careful not throwing the baby out with the bathwater on this as well.
Debbie, obviously, you know, there's always been, well, for a long time, there's been franchising, and you know, the DfE line in the report is that it helps to kind of widen access and so on. But, you know, one of the kind of big players in this area has got a tuition fee income of 72 million in the last accounts. And that's presumably after the money has been retained by the franchising university, and a pre-tax profit of 39 million. And was the loan scheme ever designed to generate those sorts of profits?
I think it is. I think it is quite telling when you look at the discourse around the mainstream part of the sector, and the large institutions that are predominantly kind of publicly funded, and the kind of the struggle in that part of the sector to make ends meet on UK tuition fees, you know, which are increasingly subsidised from international tuition fees, and actually some of these private providers will be offering international education as well, so some of that profit may relate to that, but you know, given that the margins on home student education are generally thought to be extremely tight indeed, the fact that it apparently is possible to deliver validated provision with profit margins at that scale should at the very least be raising an awful lot of eyebrows, because I don't know how you do that unless you are unless either the kind of the mainstream part of the sector is kind of quietly siphoning off lots and lots of tuition fee to fund things that are unrelated to teaching. So some of this might be about sort of smaller estates and that sort of thing. But the sort of scale of that profit is raising questions. And I think there's quite an interesting kind of parallel with the case that's been making the headlines over the past couple of weeks, the postmasters and the post office. And what was very clearly, at the sort of institutional side, an awful lot of people, you know, either convincing themselves or outright lying about what's going on, you know, that what's going on is fine, and you know, looking at information in front of them and saying, well, I can't, this doesn't sort of match with my view of the world, so I'm not going to kind of engage with it. I mean, we'll never really know what happened inside the institution that caused such a problem. them. But there is, I think, some lessons to be learned about institutional levels of interest in things that look a bit inconvenient. The questions being asked should be very much about sort of saying, how can we be absolutely sure? Not about saying, we've probably got to assume this is fine.
But I mean, but that's interesting, isn't it, Nicola? Because our sort of quality assurance norms in the sector, to some extent, depend on a level of curiosity and independence within a large institution where lots of people feel free to kind of speak their minds. But I can imagine a scenario where some people are kind of sat around in a working group and the chair reminds everyone how important this income is, and everyone suddenly kind of backs off from asking the difficult questions.
I think that's absolutely right. And there's always this tension between autonomy, which is so strongly associated with the success of our sector, and allowing those sort of practices to happen because you want the university to succeed. And I mean, you can see how governing bodies very much focused on the bottom line, as Debbie says, or as you just said, are just not going to want to challenge these sort of things, because by challenging it, you could be drawing attention to financial vulnerabilities. And I mean, you know, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think that's why you need a regulator, because the incentives in this sort of environment push towards behaviour that may simply not be in the public interest. And I think Debbie's point about making the comparisons with the post office is really interesting. I mean, it's not as extreme, obviously, but the way the financial pressures can slowly and corrosively erode that sense of what, you know, the right thing is to do is just there is a parallel there.
And I think as well, I think what's really important to say is, you know, because one of the things that is very clear, it's certainly in these cases, somebody's lying to somebody, but it is perfectly possible, I think, for most people in the ecosystem that kind of creates these situations to be acting in good faith, or at least with a kind of only a degree of, with only a kind of moderate degree of willful blindness. I think this is just sort of human beings. And I think, you know, and I mean, yes, I do agree with Nicola. I mean, this is why kind of, you know, tight regulation is really important.
Jonathan, should we know who the providers are? Because, you know, we don't know the name of any of the providers, do we? And this is public money and so on. Should we know by now?
Yeah, well, so that's exactly what I was going to suggest. Because surely the issue should be that, you know, the example of the accounts you just gave, Jim, is an extreme version of profiteering, and it's profiteering on public money. And what I would like to know is whether the universities that are franchising to that provider are aware of the high levels that the provider is taking on that. And I think the only way you can do that is to move to some form of transparency where we understand these relationships, because, as you say, it's public funding. If it wasn't public funding, then that's fair enough. That's a private matter. And that's why I said, I think the issue here is because we have a student loan book, which is backed by government. That's why it is in the public interest to understand these things.
Yes, I guess the other thing is this is student debt, isn't it? And, you know, in some cases, presumably, students are now spending the rest of their life kind of paying this off. And one of the things that kind of strikes me from a choice point of view, Debbie, is that if we look at the franchised two providers, the alternative providers here, we can't see the kind of outcomes for those providers, can we?
Yes, and I think there's a kind of broader question here about the sort of the presumption that franchise provision can widen participation, I think, is a truism. You know, of course it can. But you really need to, you want to be very kind of clear about if it. So some of this relates to the kind of the location of the provision, often, you know, which is often in London, which is not exactly underserved for higher education provision. Whereas you're not going to see franchise provision from independent providers popping up in parts of the country where there isn't a kind of established market. And I think that does rather undermine the kind of WP case. But yes, also, you know, the student experience and the quality of what's provided, the sorts of courses, again, those for which there is a market, there's absolutely no kind of shame in providing for a demand if the quality is there. But if we can't see the student outcomes, the rest of the sector is feeling extremely kind of scrutinized on you know, what are often some sort of very, very, very modest kind of challenges around student outcomes. So to have this part of the sector, you know, completely invisible, I think doesn't kind of, it's essentially a very inconsistent approach, and I think probably kind of damages the idea that the sector as a whole is working collectively together to expand access to higher education.
Hmm. Nicola, what do you think should happen next here?
Right. Well, can I just follow up on the point that Debbie's made, in that interestingly, the report notes that quite a lot of these courses are business and management courses. And we know from some of the work that OFS has done that they are concerned about the quality and outcomes there. So there's a sort of picture emerging, isn't there, of a a sort of vulnerability in the quality and legitimacy of these courses. What should be done? Well, I think with the spike in numbers, the spike in apparent fraud suggests that there needs to be a shift in terms of the focus. And it looks like that's what's going to happen. And I think there needs to be a very tight agreement between DfE, OFS and the SLC with very clear responsibilities and a prioritisation of this work. I mean, I'm not saying anything very original here because that's pretty much what the NEO suggests. But I think what comes over really strongly from that report, and I mean, this was an issue when I was at the OFS, but not quite as extreme as it is now, is this lack of powers. And this is the sort of area that needs powers. And whether it's, you know, within the DfE or the OFS or the SSC, I don't think it really matters as long as there's absolute transparency about responsibilities and accountability. And I rather agree with you. I think there needs to be greater transparency about the providers. I suspect part of that is to do with the fact that if these names were published, and you know, there'll be all sorts of legal caveats about that, but if they were published, would that disincentivize providers from reporting concerns to the SLC and the OFS? So I think there's an element of pragmatism in all of this. But I mean, this is public funding. I think the public needs, you know, that we need, and students need to have transparency about who these providers are, not least the students who are being exploited right at the end of the chain here.
Yeah. Debbie, do you think there ought to be, you know, perhaps a category of registration for providers who are being franchised too?
I mean, possibly. The question, I think, is I'm sort of questioning whether the Public Accounts Committee, whether a kind of classic call for evidence will actually surface some of this, is the extent to which there is a visible, you know, there's a visibility of an evidence base. And I think, you know, I think certainly there should be, you know, I don't know about category of registration per se, but certainly I think there should be an expectation either for the franchising institution or for the providing institution to be able to provide, you know, the relevant kind of data sets. The question I have is whether, and you know, and then of course you get into questions about burden and all the rest of it and kind of capability. But you know, that you know, that's probably the debate. The question I think is about, do people feel, are what we're talking about is a sort of incompetence and misalignment of incentives that can be sort of, you know, regularized with, you know, most actors in the system working in good faith and a sort of handful perhaps not? Or are we talking about a kind of systemic premise that requires a degree of bad faith for it to work at all? And actually, it's going to be quite hard to get evidence of that, isn't it? Because lots and lots of people are invested in not, you know, making sure that evidence doesn't exist. So, you know, I think there does need to be a kind of, we do sort of need to go in and sort of, I guess, in good faith, but with a degree of suspicion, you know, if the evidence of, you know, in order to really understand what's happening here. So I think until we kind of have a really strong sense of the scale of, you know, of bad faith actors and in that system, it's going to be very hard to know what the kind of right regulatory response is.
And actually, can I just add to that, Jim, that I think this question of there being no regulation of agents is, you know, a big concern. I hope that's looked at very closely, because I think the role of agents in this context is of concern.
Yes, my sort of top tip is to choose a series of European languages and then put in Student Finance England into TikTok in those languages, and you will find all sorts of dodgy things going on. At least to my mind, they look dodgy. Jonathan, this, you know, if you go back to that kind of profit thing, is it even possible to deliver what we know to be higher education on those sorts of margins? You know, what do we think higher education is, and do the kind of current definitions, the kind of minimums in the OFSB conditions actually kind of deliver it, do you think?
Well, the short answer to that is no. As we're discussing in a few minutes, and we look at the accounts of universities, that they're increasingly in deficit, which says that you cannot take that level of profit. Now, clearly, these providers are focusing on high margin courses and what like. But I think that, you know, that gets us back to the quality question. But one other point I would just make in reading the NAO report was, it struck me that here's an example of actually where the systems work quite well. In Britain today is not often occurring, because there's this issue, and it's quite a niche issue, which has increased in recent years. There is evidence of fraud. The various regulators raise that to the audit committees within government, and then the National Audit Office has picked up on that, and that's gone to the PAC. You know, that's how the system is designed to work. So in terms of solutions, I do think we need to let the PAC go through that process. But as Debbie said, it may be that the type of recommendations coming out of the PAC are not of sufficient detail, and we may need to, as a sector, go beyond that. But actually, I think the systems work quite well in this case.
Good. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Chris Webb, and I work as a career consultant at the University of Huddersfield, focusing specifically on supporting final year students and graduates with their career development and managing the transition from education to employment. This week, along with my HE Careers colleague, Natalie Freeman, UEA Award Officer at the University of East Anglia, I wrote for Wonky about building the careers bridge between HE, FE and secondary education, and why it's so important that careers professionals and other staff involved in delivering careers and employability in the HE sector have a better understanding of policy developments in the wider careers landscape, and also how careers education, information, advice and guidance is being delivered at all stages of education, so that this can inform our own strategy and practice. In the article, Natalie and I write about how recent policy proposals from both the current government and the opposition for an all-age career system could have an impact on how we deliver careers and employability in a higher education context, the importance of learning from secondary education and FE colleagues about how they're delivering career support to students, and some practical steps that are already being taken to help build the careers bridge between schools, colleges and universities, including skills award partnerships between universities and local schools, podcasts for heads of sixth forms detailing what students can expect from their university career service, and collaborating with student ambassadors to help promote the benefit of engaging with careers and employability support.
Now, next up this week, talk of market exit is in the air, Jonathan.
Well, yes, Jim, there are lots of euphemisms in this space, market exit, loss of provision, all describing the unthinkable idea that a university or universities could go bust. And as Jess Lister and Jonathan Simons reminded us on a piece in Wonky this week, the current system is actually designed to allow universities to go bust. The 2016 white paper actually stated, and I quote, "The possibility of an exit is a natural part of a healthy, competitive, well-functioning market, and the government will not, as a matter of policy, seek to prevent this from happening." And this has gone up the agenda because of a report that Universities UK commissioned from PwC, which was published earlier in the week. Strongly recommend reading this report. It is not long, but it's got a lot of really good detailed stuff in there. And whilst it is quite sort of pessimistic, it's not all doom and gloom. There are some sort of helpful suggestions and opportunities to allow the sector to move to improve financial sustainability. But at its heart, as the report points out, the problem is quite simple. We have this perfect storm of increased costs and a risk of declining revenues within sort of entrenched cross subsidies that have been around for over a generation. And the report concludes that there are about 40% of the universities examined are forecasting a deficit in 23-24. A couple of things I took out of the report was the high level of staff costs. 54% of all costs are staff costs. That's perhaps not surprising because university and educations are people businesses. But if you want to reduce costs, that means you basically are reducing staff. The well-documented real-term decline in student fees, estimated now to be in England at £6,000 a year and arguably lower in Scotland, and the losing money on research with recovery now at full economic costs at around 68%. So you combine all of these issues and you have a loss-making environment, which traditionally has been filled in by subsidies from international students. But as the PwC report identifies, there's an increased risk that the flow of international students could decline, partly as a result of government strategy in reducing immigration and tightening up on the graduate route. And that's the real risk in all of this. Now, worth pointing out that whilst we on this podcast and probably most of our listeners see this as a problem, there are people who actually see this as an opportunity. There's a column in The Telegraph this week by Michael Deacon, who wrote, and again, I quote, "The collapse of our universities is one of the best things that could happen to Britain." So whilst we often frame this as a technocratic issue, I don't think we should lose sight of the politics. So I guess the questions, Jim, here is, I think the problem is well understood, and it is a truly wicked one. I think the solution is much, much harder in how do we move to financial sustainability? And secondly, how do we think about the unthinkable? So if we did see a university going bust with high number of students, how do we protect those students? And what is the process for that going forward?
Nicola, obviously, as Jonathan and Jess point out on the site this week, there's a kind of underpinning assumption, I guess, that when, you know, kind of DfE was originally talking about, you know, the idea that market exit was a healthy part of a kind of market, the assumption was that they were talking about perhaps challenger providers, new providers, small providers whose students perhaps could be moved to another institution. It almost certainly wasn't written around a kind of large established university, was it?
I'm sure that's right. But I think what they would have said is that there is a massive distinction between a managed exit and a disorderly exit. So a managed exit is where, say, you know, student numbers are declining, suggesting students no longer want to study those courses or go to that particular provider. And therefore, its exit is managed in a way that protects students, stakeholders, staff, and so on. And I think that's what was envisaged. I think no one on the planet, with maybe the exception of the Daily Telegraph columnist, would want to see a disorderly exit where everyone loses out. And actually, I mean, even the Daily Telegraph columnist, I think his point, expressed in slightly absurd terms, was that in his view, too many people are going to university. So that was his point, rather than that he sort of, you know, embraced the prospect of universities going bankrupt. So I think the point here is how to ensure that any market failures are managed in a way that protects students. So that, I think, is what the DfE was getting at when they made that point.
I guess the interesting point, Nicola, is I've been refamiliarising myself with student protection plans over the past week or so, and I can't find a student protection plan that says there's a kind of material risk of institutional failure. So I'm struggling to kind of link up what institutions are saying under the kind of regulatory regime about risk and how a failure would be managed, and then the PwC report, which seems to tell a completely different story. What's kind of going on there?
Well, I think what's going on is that student protection. Look, I'm not speaking for the OFS here. Obviously, I left over a year ago. Well, more than that. So, you know, this is just my own perspective on it. But student protection plans are very risk-based. So if you've got a thriving, successful university where there's no serious risk of insolvency or failure, then the student protection plan that's published is likely to be like quite light touch. Where the regulators got concerned about financial viability, and that will include some of the ones that the PwC reports identify, or doesn't identify but refers to, then the OFS will be in close discussion with the university and about a whole manner of interventions. And one of them will be sharpening up the student protection plan. Well, not just sharpening up, but making it, you know, really bite and protect students. And there'll be an ongoing process of exchange about that. And one thing that's in the public domain but is often missed in this is that back in 2021, so that's when I was there, there was a new regulatory condition to protect students, Student Protection Direction C4, I think, might be wrong on that. But anyway, what that did is give the OFS powers to intervene when it was concerned about institutional failure, and it introduced powers to require really robust and detailed student protection plans. And I think the problem is, Jim, that that's not visible. That's happening behind the scenes. And obviously, there'll be communications with the student unions who'll be involved. But basically, it's an engagement that is going on below the radar, risk dependent on risk, and is probably happening across the sector, but we just don't see it.
Debbie, if you were attending an open day today, and you look at the PwC report, I think you'd make a decent guess that by the time you get to your sort of third year, you probably won't be experiencing the things that you were told about on the open day, and it's all the things that a university might do to avoid collapse that might radically change the student experience. But there doesn't feel like a lot of protection there either, does there?
Yeah, I mean, well, there is protection. There's protection in the form of the quality regime, and of course, there's a conversation about whether the quality regime then sort of delivers that. If the thing is based around student outcomes, how those outcomes are produced, and the things that are kind of, you know, made available to call, you know, to create the environment in which those outcomes are produced, being kind of less and less, you know, as I guess the quality regime is agnostic about that, as long as students are getting the outcomes. I guess it is inevitable that if a university has less money, they're going to be trying to find ways to to save money. And some of that is going to hit the student experience. I mean, we saw in the 90s, you know, this is the sort of ebb and flow of higher education funding. And I think, you know, we certainly shouldn't underestimate kind of what the consequences that are in terms of kind of strain on staff and impact on student experience. That said, good universities, you know, that are well led and that are well financially managed, will sort of see some of this coming. And I think this is kind of particularly where, in the autumn, senior people at the OFS were kind of warning very strongly about avoiding optimism bias in projections, because this is all about being really, really realistic about your likely future income. You know, given notwithstanding kind of often policy changes kind of faster than financial projections can kind of accommodate, but you know, adjusting, making decisions. Understanding the cost base and making decisions that mean that those consequences don't happen. So the kind of what you're describing is a sort of, oh my goodness, we don't have any money. Let's remove this. Let's remove that. Let's not offer that anymore. And you know, inevitably there'll be some of that will be happening. But you know, hopefully based on judgments about what is going to materially impact student experience and what is, you know, to all intents and purposes, nice to have. And you know, and if a good quality experience is not able to be provided, then you have to kind of make some tough decisions about whether that course is viable or not. And you know, not every university is going to be doing this kind of flawlessly, and certainly the environment isn't such that it is really possible to do it flawlessly. But I think you have to kind of assume a degree of good faith in attempting to kind of make good decisions about what is actually possible to be delivered, you know, because that's what the, you know, that's what the quality regime demands, and that's what kind of good practice demands.
But if you're at that open day today, presumably you're hoping, you know, you're making a set of decisions about whether to go to that provider and indeed to go to a provider at all on more than you'll actually get to the second year, you'll actually complete the course, you'll actually get a graduate job. I mean, presumably on one level, you're choosing a bunch of things that are kind of interesting and that are to some extent sold to you on that day. Should it be okay for a provider to say, well, do you know what? The alternative would be to go under, so we're going to halve the number of modules you get to choose from in your third year.
The answer is, well, those things are regulated by, that's kind of the point, isn't it? You have to make a judgment about whether it's likely to be possible to continue to deliver for the full breadth of the course, right? So if And then you have to judge kind of what the demand for those modules is likely to be. So I mean, if at the point of advertising the course you said these modules will be available, and then you don't make them available, then you are in breach of your kind of contract with the student. I mean, that's just, you know, that system already exists. Now the fact that some providers might do that, and then, you know, and then de facto be in breach of, and you know, it would obviously be a bad thing, even if they sort of said yes, but we don't have any money, and this is why we had to do it. The things I think that are perhaps more material is about the kind of the things that cause the in some ways, actually, I mean, some students will care an awful lot about module choice, but a lot of students will care more about the atmosphere on campus. And I think the atmosphere on campus is the thing that is probably going to be stripped out. It's going to be about the opening hours of services and the activities that are going on and the funding available for the students' union to put on stuff that makes
the shuttle bus
campus the place you want to be. And so that's where I think, you know, you go to an open day and you see the best face of the university, and you get a lovely vibe of kind of lots of buzzy activity. As the money drains away, the buzz disappears, and that's kind of got a really material impact on your kind of your sense of belonging and your ability to thrive and all, you know, and a lot of that is not stuff that is really regulated by the quality regime, and that's where to some extent that's where the worry is. I think people really radically underestimate the importance of, you know, student support and campus community, not people in the sector, but people kind of people thinking about funding in the sector. This is why Michael Deacon can say it wouldn't matter if universities collapsed, because, you know, not realizing that education happens in a community. That's why people, why people continue to go to university when they could still, you know, when they could just do a course online. It's because of the community and the support infrastructure and the environment that people are studying in.
Well, so yeah, I agree absolutely with what Debbie just said. I do think it's about community, and it's not only the student community, it's the local community as well. So if a university went bust, it'd have profound effects on a local economy. And indeed, that's why politically, you know, that may not be allowed to happen, but you know, we'll have to see that play out. Just a couple of comments here. So, we can discuss the detail of what happens if and when there is a so-called market exit. And that is clearly important, and I'm not belittling that. But the fundamental question here is that the current funding regime is no longer working in the interests of students staff and universities. And I think many people have seen that for a long time coming, and we're starting to hit crunch time. And we need to have that conversation, and we aren't having that conversation. And I don't have the answers. It's a difficult conversation to have. But I do think the system is getting to the point of being broken, and it does need reform in that sense. And then my final observation is every time I sort of find myself in a conversation about student finance, after sort of my pre-university career, you know, I ran a think tank that employed about 100 people. We never knew if we would have enough money to pay salaries 3 to 6 months out. And we were constantly trying to sell to fill that pipeline to ensure that we could pay people. Universities have this incredible luxury of this 3-year timeframe. And whilst I absolutely accept and do not want to belittle the financial situation we're in compared to other sectors, despite that, the universities are actually in a more secure space when it comes to looking at certainties and uncertainties.
So much of students' lives takes place under the radar, yet it's students' encounters around campus, their confidence in independent learning, and the pressures of juggling their work and personal commitments that shape how they engage with learning and teaching. To really enable students to thrive requires knowing about the full extent of their lives, not just the bits that universities can most readily see and touch. But time and money are in short supply for universities and students, and with no let-up on funding in sight, carefully choosing interventions that will help students to both survive and thrive has become more important and even tougher. Deepening our collective understanding of what is in university's gift to influence and how to do the things that make a difference is vital. So at our Secret Life of Students event, we'll be interrogating the contemporary higher education policy questions through the student lens, bringing together sector leaders and managers, as well as student leaders and student union managers, to find out how to respond in the student interest. What role should universities and student unions play in stoking or calming conflict on campus? What are the expectations that we should place on students themselves to create a good learning experience? And how are they learning? And how can we both measure it and support it outside of the classroom? On the day, we'll round up key findings into the student experience from the past year, and we'll launch exciting new findings on the student experience beyond the classroom. That's the Secret Life of Students, London, 12th of March. See you there. Now, UCAS has published its end of cycle data, Nicola, and there's some interesting tales about providers here.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. So this is the data that's disaggregated by provider and subject and some student characteristics. Though actually the quality data is still to come later this month, I think. But anyway, it's been published for the 23 cycle. And all the usual caveats about the fact that it doesn't include international students and there's more limited coverage in Scotland. Nonetheless, there is a really strong overall sort of story, really, that Russell Group institutions, or at least some of them, have gained student numbers, but most of the other groups have seen numbers decline. And I mean, even within those groupings, obviously there's huge variation, but nonetheless, there is a reduction in applications. And the UCAS data, it's well presented, it's really interesting and worth looking at. But I mean, this is going to sound really obsequious because I'm doing a wonky podcast, but I do think David Kernan's analysis and his tableaus that's on Wonky Today, it's just so clear and so helpful. So, and you can just play around and look at individual providers, and it's very easy and it's just fascinating. So I do recommend that. And I'm not going to pick out any particular providers, but just a few points that came over to me quite strongly is that if you look at the subjects, that's kind of really fascinating. So you've got real reductions in design, creative and industries and performing arts, which I think is just really worrying in terms of not just the future of those subjects, but also, you know, the economies that sit around it. But massive variation within that subject. So many universities seeing numbers going down, except Russell Group, where they go up. And within that, actually, small specialists are quite vulnerable. That's a point, incidentally, that was picked up by the PwC report that we were just talking about. So huge variation, but down. And then the area that's just catastrophically down, continually declining, is modern foreign languages. And that includes the Russell Group, minus 8.8% down. And I do think as a sector, as a country, we've just got to take this more seriously. What is happening about our lack of commitment to learning foreign languages? You know, we're going to become a mono, well, not quite, but we're going to, the assumption is that everyone else speaks English, and that is just complete nonsense. And we really need to take this more seriously, and it needs more coordination and more political urgency, I think. And then you see law going up, you know, isn't that rather sad? Education and teaching down. Anyway, so all these trends are documented, and I think it makes for fascinating reading. So there we go. The tableaus and the analysis is there, and it's to be looked at.
Jonathan, in some ways, the you know, the kind of numbers speak for themselves, don't they? I mean, if you have a fundamentally demand-led system and you don't have any planning, this is the sort of thing that happens, isn't it?
Yes. And there, you know, there's a number of different drivers in that, aren't there? So there's going to be demographic trends, which obviously are currently increasing, but as I recall, predicted to fall off, at least in England, in 2030. But I think there's variance by different nations around that. And then there's obviously the propensity to apply to go to university, which, you know, in the current sort of climate is at least challenged in the public rhetoric quite often, as indicated in the Telegraph column I quoted earlier. And then, as Nicola's pointed out, you have, within that demand, you have variances by both, institutions and subject areas. And, you know, these data do fluctuate, don't they, year to year, because that demand inevitably fluctuates year to year. So it's hard to, I find it really hard to draw out sort of meaningful inferences from these data because they are so noisy for understandable reasons.
But Debbie, this issue about, you know, some, you know, just take the, you know, Nicola's point about modern languages, the sense that, you know, most parts of the country have kind of got a set of big university, you know, multi-subject universities, that's starting to be challenged, isn't it? As the numbers tick through each year.
In the sense that the, most universities are delivering the full range of subjects.
Yeah.
Actually, some subjects are essentially shrinking. I mean, yeah, I think, that because even if in a number controlled system you still have a market and you still have demand, and I think it is telling, I think, with the caveat, of course, that, you know, I sort of share Nicola's concern about where, you know, with their foreign languages, because it is, you know, it's obviously kind of part of a kind of rich diversity of subjects and a very important one for our kind of long-term place in the world, you know, to some extent, I think you just have to sort of accept that some subjects will just be popular, and it is notable, I think, that kind of, you know, decades of efforts to kind of to resuscitate modern languages study in university has not apparently led to significant change, and so some, you know, there are kind of just larger forces at work than can necessarily be achieved. I think, you know, and I think also. And again, I say this as someone with an English degree. I mean, and there is a kind of worry about, you know, what is perceived as a decline in the humanities. I think you do need to sort of situate this in a kind of larger context. University study is not necessarily the kind of vehicle for people to, you know, it's not the only vehicle for people to learn and express their interests. So, you know, what we're not seeing, I think, is a sort of decline. We're not seeing a decline in the cultural and creative sectors. Certainly, maybe a decline in funding, but you know, not a decline in interest and participation. You know, they continue to flourish, you know, in different ways. Likewise, you know, it is possible to kind of learn and engage in foreign languages in ways other than university study. So, there will be a natural kind of shifting in the pattern of subject provision. And I think the thing that is probably the conversation that's probably quite important to have internally to an institution is about, to what extent do these subjects, you know, contribute to the character of our institution? What are they doing in the kind of broader picture? What purpose are they serving in our local area? When at a kind of as a sort of core thing, and this is not about sort of, you know, for some subjects this is about, you know, educating lawyers and doctors and social workers and teachers, and some subjects this is about giving people an opportunity to immerse themselves in something that they care about with a view to kind of developing a skill set that will serve them well in their future lives, and that you know, that is a slightly different proposition. So I think you've just got to be quite sort of pragmatic about you know, sort of thinking about what is the subject doing in our world, in the world that we live in, and to what extent is this something that we can, you know, how can we ensure that that those kind of agendas are realized, but perhaps not necessarily by delivering a range of modules in this subject, but if the demand just simply isn't there. That was quite a long-winded way of saying we should care about it, but also not wring our hands about it, I think.
Nicola, one of my favorite of DK's visualizations in the article today is when DK says, I know some people like a map. What he means is DK likes maps, but but I quite like maps too. And you know, I guess, you know, on the one hand, you know, just from a raw access point of view, in a lot of cases, students can only attend a university that's nearby. In some cases, there are parts of our politics that want more students to study more locally rather than the kind of boarding school model of going off to another part of the country. But, you know, as subjects contract and perhaps concentrate in particular institutions, that just the kind of access to the breadth of subjects from some bits of the country gets really restricted, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think that's why we need to balance supply and demand a bit more than we're doing at the moment. I mean, I entirely agree with what Debbie says about it having to be demand-led in terms of student choice. But on the other hand, I mean, you're quite right about regional prioritisation. That's really important. But I think we also need to acknowledge that student choices are going to be constrained by what's available, obviously their ability to move and travel. And I think, therefore, we need a better balance between thinking how we can construct supply to enable proper student choice rather than just assuming student choice can dictate supply. It's just not that simple. And we've seen it happen in certain areas. I mean, if we look at the prioritization of STEM subjects within schools and feeding into university, I mean, that's really had a remarkable and positive impact. And there was one program that the OFS ran, which was to incentivize postgraduate masters in AI for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. Again, I can't quite remember the detail, but that was the thrust of it. And it was very successful. So you can incentivize subjects that are needed, whether on a regional basis or on a national basis. And I just think we haven't quite got that balance right, that there needs to be more thinking about how we can support that kind of supply, because ultimately that then does enable better student choice. And you're right to focus on the maps, and DK, if that is his interest, is right to focus on geography, because if you're born and brought up and educated at school in certain areas, then the truth is that you might have far fewer choices and aspirations and expectations, and that just is unacceptable in as part of our access and participation agenda. So I think there's a lot that sits behind this in terms of how students make their decisions that is revealed really in the way the maps in particular are expressed, but all of the data really.
And finally, 82% of universities now pay a living wage, Debbie. Great news.
Yeah, this is excellent. I mean, this is very much Jonathan's story, and I'll sort of, you know, he should definitely kind of take the crown. So for a number of years now, Jonathan's been basically assessing using the tools at his disposal to find out which universities in the UK are either accredited with the Living Wage Foundation, which means that they are not only paying a living wage to their own staff, but they're also ensuring working with their contractors to make sure that they are doing that too, and that they're generally kind of validated on all fronts. And some universities that have made an informal undertaking with their staff or a public undertaking to pay a living wage. And that, you know, thanks, I suspect, in no small measure to Jonathan's efforts to raise the profile of the issue, to also kind of work, you know, point universities in the direction of the Living Wage Foundation. There was a session at the HE Festival in November, exploring, you know, how to get accredited. That number has doubled over the past 2 years of accredited universities. And so this is really good news, and I think shows what can be done with a bit of concerted effort and focus. You know, even in the teeth of, you know, what is really some quite challenging financial times for universities, as we've discussed sort of at some length in previous items.
Nicola, obviously we were talking about financial sustainability earlier. At least in theory, if Labour get elected, one of the things that will happen relatively quickly is that what's currently the kind of optional living wage, the real living wage, will become the living wage, and that will, you know, we'd have to assume that the government won't instantly increase fees to be able to cover it, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I think that's right, and it's going to have differential impact on different universities depending on their financial sustainability. I mean, one of the things that when I was reading Jonathan's article is I just so wanted to know, who are the universities, and are they not paying because they can't afford it and they really are up against it? or not. And it would be great, Jonathan, at some point to know who the universities are.
So, Jonathan, come on, Mike, shame them, shame them.
Nope. They know who they are. I can give a sort of response to that. I do know that there are a small number who, out of almost a point of principle, think it is wrong to have their wage levels dictated by a third party. There will be others, and I know of a couple of others that definitely do it on financial sustainability grounds. I have to point out that I find the financial sustainability argument quite weak for two reasons. One, the difference between the statutory minimum wage and the living wage is, £1.5 per hour. And the number of people on a minimum wage in the university is relatively low. When we did this at King's, and we accredited, the financial impact of that was not large at all. And far more importantly than the accounts is the moral arguments, because basically if you say that we're not going to pay the living wage on financial sustainability grounds, you're basically saying we're exploiting our lowest paid staff to keep this business in a viable sense. And I just find that quite a, frankly, repugnant position to take. But I do think that I do think this is a good news story for the sector, and we should be focusing on that. And I think the challenges going forward are A, to persuade more universities to accredit, because, as Debbie said, because of the third party contractors come into that, and I think that's an important sector. And secondly, to put pressure on those 22 to sign up. I think the sort of student unions have a big play in this, as well as staff unions in trying to push that agenda.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Nicola, Debbie, Jonathan, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Until then, stay wonky.